Morbid Collective.
Welcome to Criminal AF, and for those of you joining us for the first time, this is a true crime podcast. There will be talk of murder, rape, torture, assault, and pretty much any crime that would haunt your nightmares at any given moment. There will be detailed descriptions of said events, and there will be some vulgar language.
Like fuck.
We understand that Criminal AF is not for everyone, but we just ask that you at least give it a listen. If it's not for you, hey, thanks for checking it out.
See ya.
But if it is, welcome to the debauchery. Today we're going to discuss some shitty parents who have stabbed, bludgeoned, and set fire. Yes, you heard that right. Set fire to their own children. These are three of the shittiest of shitty people who unfortunately walk this earth. I'm Dave Jari.
I'm Garrett Quarter.
And this is Criminal as Fuck. That's Criminal. What's good, true crime douchebags? Welcome to another episode of Criminal AF. Once again, I am Dave Jari, and with me is my co-host, Garrett Quarter.
How we doing?
Before we jump into this, I just want to put it out there that on the 19th of this month, I'll be going under the knife. I'm having gastric bypass surgery to hopefully help remedy a personal struggle I've been dealing with for some years. So what does this mean for Criminal AF? Hopefully nothing, but possibly, might be a short hiatus for a couple of weeks or three, or, it depends on how I feel, and we'll see how everything goes. But I just want to put that out there so you're all aware of what's going on here. And actually, Garrett's going to Mexico.
I'm going to Mexico. Well, I'm going to Mexico. You're getting an
arriba.
You can say arriba.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you know how many drunk people down in Mexico just yell out fucking, like, hanging out on the beach out drunk? Con leche! The lady's like, I speak English.
Yeah. All right, now that that's put out in the universe, we got to give a shout out to our newest member of the Debauched, and that's Kaylee Fraz. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right, Kaylee. As well as an upgraded member, Courtney Seddon. Thank you so much, Kaylee and Courtney, for being part of our fucked up family.
Thank you guys so much.
You can become a member of the Debauch by joining our Patreon for as little as $2 a month for general support. Everyone gets access to our private Discord as well as ad-free episodes. And those who join the $5 tier above get all of our audible, visual, and downloadable content. And for the higher tiers, you get all of this plus producer credits. And, there's some goodies thrown in, like t-shirts, posters, coffee mugs, etc. To choose your tier, just go to
criminalasfuck.com
and click on the support tab. There are other ways to support Criminal AF as well. You can visit our show on Apple Podcasts, where you can give us 5 stars and leave a detailed review on why Criminal AF is
the number one true crime podcast in the world.
You can also go to Spotify and answer the questions or polls that are posted with each episode. One other way to help us out is you can be rocking our merch.
Go get you some merch.
Yes, sir. I gotta get the voice thing over here. There are tons of designs and products to choose from, and you can find them on the shop tab over at criminalasfuck.com. I'd like to bring everyone's attention to the website Morbid Collective. Morbid Collective is a group of independent podcasts I'm putting together to share and cross-promote each other's shows. So far, we have us, Criminal AF, Fright Flick FMK, True Crime University, and we'll be adding a couple more shows to the collective in October, namely the show Freaky As Fuck.
You're a very freaky girl. You get it from a mama. Then she gives you brain in the backseat of a Hummer.
Oh, shit. Chris Owen, our friend and researcher for the show, and also the co-host for Freaky As Fuck, will be joining us a little later in the show to give her share her own story of a shitty parent. So stay tuned for that.
Ooh.
Yes, so you can follow all of our friends at morbidcollective.com or follow the link in the episode description. Speaking of, let's pop in real quick with our friend Debbie over at True Crime University.
So you like to listen to people talk about crime, but did you ever wonder why criminals do the things they do? Like what makes them tick? My name is Debbie, and I'm the professor at True Crime University. Join me in the classroom Thursdays, wherever you get your podcasts, for intellectual discussions about crime, psychology, and why criminals do what they do. See you there.
What in the fuck is going on in Florida?
Mm-hmm.
Breaking news! Florida man arrested for torching car belonging to his cousin, who's also his girlfriend.
No way.
A Florida man was arrested Wednesday for arson after he allegedly torched a car belonging to his girlfriend and cousin. I love how they just throw it in there.
Yeah.
Who are one and the same several months ago. Melvin Allen.
Melvin.
A-L-A-I-N. How do you say that?
Elaine.
A-L-A-I-N. Elaine. Melvin Elaine Cintron. 37 was caught on camera lighting his cousin and lover's Jaguar XE sedan on fire. Ooh, she's rocking the
Jag.
Oh, I know why he's with his cousin. It's his little sugar mama, too. Yeah.
Was it tax season?
The memes with the guys that are sitting behind their girlfriend at the ATM, like doing the little like couple hold, the prom pose at the ATM, dude.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Set his cousin and lover's Jaguar XE sedan on fire in front of a North Miami home on April 29th. Investigators determined the sedan belonged to Cintron's girlfriend, but we were unable to interview Cintron. What a name. But we were unable to interview her Monday, the station report. She initially said her car caught fire as she drove home because she was afraid of what Cintron would do if she told cops the truth.
Ooh,
yeah, and he looks like he would put hands on her, too. We'll include the mugshot in the description. She initially said her car caught on fire as she drove home because she was afraid of what Cintron would do.
Yeah.
Whenever she spoke to investigators about what happened to her car, her boyfriend made her put her phone on speaker. Oh red flag,
shit.
Baby. Abusive relationship. Red it's your cousin.
I know. That's going to make the fucking reunions really awkward.
Yeah, but I mean, if we're openly dating cousins, that family probably got a little rig-a-ding-ding-ding.
Did they know, though? I mean, was that public knowledge or did it just come out?
For everybody at home listening, send in your cousin loving story. You know what I mean? We'll see if this is more frequent than we think. Because, right, if you're okay with third cousins. Third cousins is socially acceptable? Are we on the same page?
Third cousins are outside of the DNA, or far enough outside of the DNA chain.
Listen,
where
I'm not picky. I don't care. Let's DNA aside. What's socially acceptable?
Not having the title cousin. But I mean, let's honestly talk here. You have a lot of cousins, right?
I have a shit ton of cousins.
Okay,
yeah.
You have third cousins.
Yes, I know fourth cousins.
Female third cousins,
huh? Yeah.
Okay. Find any of them hot?
No.
Attractive?
No, I don't.
Third cousins? No.
No, and it's not even because I'm not even bluffing. I don't know.
No?
No.
The thought
of a cousin just instantly makes them, no.
Not even like when you were younger?
No.
No?
Nope.
I guess I'm the only one then.
Well, you got a couple hot cousins?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. I'm just saying. It's third cousin is acceptable, I think.
Okay. All right. So third cousin's okay, guys. So everybody out there, you heard it first. Dave, stamp of approval.
Well,
approved.
Well, how many cousins were they?
I don't know. It doesn't say. Dude, by the look of this guy, it's probably a first cousin.
It's probably they probably lived together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Growing up.
Oh, man.
Remember last episode we were talking about how we need to get our white trash on? Yeah, I think I just exposed a little bit of my white trash.
Well, when we did Trash or Classy, I think you came up
Trashy.
You did.
Yeah.
Oh, you did. All right. So yeah, you're good. Yeah. Let's add I think my cousin's hot to the trashy list. You got another one.
All right, let's be honest. I want everybody to write in. If you have a third cousin and you found them at some point in your life attractive.
No, let's add to the mystique here. Let's build the story. All right. This goes out to the listeners. If you had a third cousin and she's hot. I'm talking.
Or he.
And he's hot. She's hot.
Yeah.
10. You guys are having a sleepover. Wait, no, this made it weird. But she comes on to you.
Yeah.
Or he comes on to you.
Yeah.
Are you taking it down?
Third cousins.
Third cousin. You're the 10 out of 10.
And you're... well, let's leave that to the listeners.
Yeah. Well, we'll get back to it when we answer. That is. I have a feeling... It depends. Most of the men in here are going to be like, yeah, dude, what are you fucking...
Right, and I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I'm you're going through, puberty, your sexual awakening or whatever.
Yeah, if I was, I would tell you the truth.
You know what I mean?
16, 17, sure, whatever. Yeah. You're not going to think straight.
I'm not saying having sex with them. I'm just saying, find them attractive, Or maybe, tug one out.
Yeah, well... I love how we get down to the nitty gritty here at Criminal AF. Studio Chloroform specializes in cousin loving.
That just went somewhere it shouldn't have. But anyway. All right.
Well, seriously, we can't talk about incest?
I know.
Come on.
Well, no, it's not incest. Once it's outside that third level, it's not incest anymore.
All right. Let's finish this.
All right. Well, we don't know. Where's that true crime douchebags button?
Yeah, true.
We need a jingle. I know. We need the jingle. True crime douchebags.
We're gonna record that on this tonight. A true crime douchebag.
Bring it back in. All right, here we go.
When she was finally able to speak freely, she told officers she fears Cintron because he carries a fully automatic gun with a double drum high capacity magazine.
Oh, you don't fuck around.
Oh, he got the fucking banana clip, boy. He looks like he carries a banana clip.
He got that blah blah.
He got that fucking the ratchet with the banana clip.
Yep.
Cintron reportedly calls the round drums on the side of the magazines the gun's tits.
The gun's tits.
I got them tits on me,
boy.
I got them tits on the chopper. All right. The unmanned woman also told police that her alleged pyromaniac boyfriend stole her purse and left her without a way home from a Miami shopping center. Cintron reportedly got jealous when he thought a bartender was flirting with his cousin. That's so funny. And the two got into an argument before he snatched her bag.
Get your eyes off my cousin, motherfucker.
Before I hit you with the tits, baby.
Before I break out the tits on my chopper. Rah, rah, rah.
Oh man, Miami's a different place, dude. Miami's where that dude got caught eating that person, right? Eating the person's face.
Miami's
wild.
Yeah.
Miami's wild. Oh, Florida. Doesn't disappoint.
All right. It's time to fuck this episode in the mouth, Garrett.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Fuck it hard.
Yeah.
So,
but yeah.
We're going to discuss three cases that involve some truly shitty parents. And first, we're going to discuss the shitbag named Timothy Jones Jr. Little history on Timothy is that...
That sounds like an NPC name.
Yeah?
Such an NPC name, Timothy Jones Jr.
Wait, what's NPC?
Like a non-playable character? Like somebody,
oh,
in,
no,
the
like,
and
like
somebody in the background?
The,
yeah.
The dudes?
No, yeah. Just somebody in the background. Like, oh. In a, like video game talk, like... Someone you don't even know is there. Just Timothy Jones Jr. You walk by their name and the character in the game, and he's just hanging out. And says Timothy Jones.
Yeah. All right.
A little Gen Z talk for you, buddy.
All right. Thanks for bringing me. Make me feel like fucking 87 years old.
Okay, boomer.
All right. So Timothy Jones Jr. He was born in 1981 to Timothy Jones Sr. Go figure.
It's just a fucking bunch of NBCs.
And Cindy Jones, who was 16 at the time she became pregnant.
Hey,
okay.
Sounds like a little Florida to me.
The elder Timothy described Cindy as violent and erratic. She behaved strangely, and she gave little Timothy Jr. laxatives as an infant and cutting up his clothes with knives.
What the fuck?
Okay. All right, Cindy. When Jones was 18 months old, Cindy left the family, and Timothy Sr. later remarried.
You know what's creepy about that? Giving a, like, at that young, you can tell she just wanted to see what happened.
Like with the laxatives?
Yeah.
Kind of like, experimenting. Yeah. Let me experiment on my baby.
Yeah, that's sinister.
Yeah.
Like, she just, like here.
Yeah.
I gotta...
Take these.
Instead of burping you and actually being a parent and, like, you know, comforting your upset stomach, I'm just gonna... Let's see what happens. That's sinister.
Right. Or if you're pissed off at your fucking husband and you're like walking out and watch the baby, I'm going to the store, and then give it laxatives just so the husband has to fucking change the shitty diaper.
Yeah, well, that's a shitty thing to do.
Yeah. Like, it's a shitty thing to do regardless to an infant. That's fucking ridiculous. All right, so in 2001...
No pun intended.
Yeah. Yeah. So in 2001, Jones Jr. was arrested in Illinois for possession of cocaine, check forgery, car theft. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison, but was released 2 years later in 2003. I wonder why he went down this path of fucking crime. Probably because his mother was a fucking psycho. And, you know, we say this before, you know, we sympathize with the child version of these people, but the adult versions, they can go fuck themselves and eat a bullet. I don't really fucking care.
Well, I mean, his wires didn't get crossed.
Mm.
Abusive family, abusive mom.
Mm.
You know, he wasn't killing people.
Yeah, well, yet.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So in 2004, 22-year-old Jones married 18-year-old Amber Kaiser. Amber gave birth to five children.
Damn.
Mara, who was born in Pennsylvania. Elias and Natan, who were born in Mississippi, and Gabriel and Abigail, who were born in South Carolina. In 2011, Jones graduated from Mississippi State University with a degree in computer engineering. Oh, smart dude. He moved to South Carolina to work as an engineer for Intel.
Damn.
Wow. Okay. All right, Timothy. You got your life going pretty well for you. He was earning a salary at approximately $71,000 annually. Now, the couple had moved into an inexpensive trailer in Lexington County in the suburbs of Columbia. Amber Jones was a stay-at-home mother, and in her testimony later in trial, she indicated that her husband believed that women are to be seen and not heard, as well as the children. Like, now we're talking like going back to like the 1940s, 1950s, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, my father used to say that when he was a kid.
Those 1950s dads, man.
Children were seen, not heard. You didn't speak, you know, especially at the dinner table, you know what I mean? It was just the parents. The dad spoke and everybody just sat there and just fucking ate their food or whatever. Like, when dad came home from work, everybody just shut the fuck up.
That people wonder, like all kids nowadays, discipline. Yeah, because my dad was the most intimidating thing in the fucking world. Of course you didn't speak in 1950. Right. Because he'd rip out that belt.
Yeah.
Like, you have literally a demon in your house.
Yeah.
Of course you're just going to sit there and eat all your fucking food and be polite. Yeah. You're just petrified.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and at one point wanted a, quote, farm full of children.
I'll never have to crowd the grass again.
Feed the goats, whatever. In May 2012, the couple temporarily separated for 2 weeks, and when Jones returned, he learned that Amber had been leaving the children home alone and was having an affair with a 19-year-old who also lived in a trailer park.
Jeez, that 19-year-old probably was, his friends were dapping him up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you got that MILF.
You got that MILF action.
Is she your cousin?
I mean, hey. All right. I wonder if he has the Pantheon columns for later.
Spice it up a little bit. Yeah. Make it a little fancy.
I wonder if he's in a nice trailer park.
He's sitting out there in his like little white tank top, arm up on the fucking column.
Trans-Am in the driveway.
Yeah, he's like, how you doing? All right. So, we didn't see this coming, but they filed for a divorce. And when it became finalized in 2013, Timothy Jones was awarded full custody.
Wow.
With Amber getting visitation rights.
Well, I mean,
so apparently Amber, you know, there was some, you know, DCF at, you know, involvement here and stuff, and found that Amber was an unfit mother, and hence why Timothy Jones got awarded full custody. She did maintain visitation and whatnot, but all right. So Timothy moved the children to another area of Lexington, and soon was under investigation for child abuse and neglect. In May 2014, one child said Jones had spanked him and made him do exercise as punishment. But since there were no visible signs of bruising, DCF considered the discipline lawful. Okay? So keep that in mind.
I mean, hey, we're down south.
Hey, keep that in mind. You can exercise your kid for punishment and get away with it.
I don't think you can in certain states.
Not up here, you can.
Not up here. No. Down south?
No.
I mean, when you
That's go, a full-fledged investigation.
Go get yourself a switch. I'm going to hit you with it. Mm. Get the biggest stick you can find
go
outside.
Go pick your switch. All right, Jones was accused of abuse and neglect again 2 weeks later. This time, the report stated that Jones beats the children often, leaving bruising. He also does not feed the children adequately. The home was reported to be filthy and in disarray, resulting in the caseworker noting that, quote, Dad appears to be overwhelmed and unable to maintain the home, unquote.
And he still stayed with them.
Yep, and now, at this time, there's this case with the DCF is open. Okay, it hasn't been closed yet. So now, on Thursday, August 28th, 2014, Timothy Jones picked up his three eldest children, Mara, Elias, and Natan, from Saks Gotha Elementary School, and his two youngest, Gabriel and Abigail, from a nearby daycare. That afternoon, Jones unsafely forced the five children out of the car at Lexington Walmart, an action for which he would later be charged with unlawful neglect. Okay. Amber Jones called the family home at 7:12 p.m. and spoke to one of her sons, Natan. After that, she could not communicate with Jones or her children. Uh-oh, something's happening.
Ooh.
What's going on? She's getting cut out. Authorities estimate that Jones most likely killed his children that night of August 28th. He wrapped their corpses in black trash bags using bleach to cover the stench of decay. Jones later admitted to killing his children on August 28th in the family home, and it's possible that the other children were dead when Amber Jones spoke to Natan. In the trial, Travis Presley, a prison guard, testified that Jones admitted to strangling his eldest daughter after she witnessed him murdering one of her brothers.
Holy shit, dude.
Jones reportedly became angry that Natan broke a electrical outlet and forced him to do physical exercises. Jones originally had claimed that he found his son dead in his bed, which encouraged him to kill the others. In his confession, Jones said that he PT'd his ass until he couldn't handle it anymore to get the child to explain what happened to the electrical outlets. However, experts suggested that Natan appeared to be strangled to death, discounting Jones' original statement. Jones admitted to strangling his youngest children with a belt, claiming their necks were too small for his hands to strangle properly.
Shit, dude, fuck this piece of shit. Yeah. And the fact that he's, like, talking about it, too.
Like, matter of fact. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Stacy Stanley.
Like, that's a brag.
Yeah. Ugh. Basically, yeah. Hence why he made the episode of Shitty Parents.
Yeah.
Stephanie Stanley, a DNA specializing agent, positively identified the mutilated bodies from matching DNA strands found in Jones's car and home. On September 1st, Jones stopped at a Dunkin' Donuts on Labor Day in Spartanburg, South Carolina. On September 3rd, he went to the West Columbia Walmart, where he purchased several items he used to mutilate his children, including large plastic bins, saws, and muriatic acid. Now, the reason we bring up the whole Dunkin' Donuts and whatnot, because this is post-murder. Mm-hmm. So he's basically going on about his day while his kids are...
getting his fucking black iced coffee.
Yeah. September 1st, the pumpkin spice comes out. That's where he went. Get his pumpkin spice latte.
Jesus.
Authorities believe his children were stored in the trunk of his car the entire time. His children were marked absent on Friday, Monday, and Tuesday, and also on September 3rd. Amber Jones contacted the authorities to inform them that she could not reach her ex-husband or her children, and that they had missed a scheduled visit at Chick-fil-A. Who misses a visit at Chick-fil-A? I'm telling you. Right, yeah,
that's the first red flag.
Yeah,
but that's their meeting point. Is
Chick-fil-A?
This is.
Hopefully, it's not on a Sunday. All right. So authorities listed the family as missing, but did not announce it to the public until the following Tuesday, September 9th, 6 days after their bodies were discovered. Police didn't issue an Amber Alert because Timothy Jones was the custodial parent, so therefore they can't be kidnapped if they're with the custodial parent, so to speak.
Dude, dad appears to be overwhelmed and unable to maintain the home.
Yeah.
This goes right back to our Adrian Jones story, too, is like DCF, man, like... you know, they do a lot of good, but fuck, like the report is right there. Now, granted,
you have to step in.
I didn't think that they probably didn't think he was going to snap over an electrical outlet and kill his whole family.
Right.
But I mean, that's a special case of nut job. But damn, man, you guys were there. Mm. The report says
dad can't take care of his kids.
Oh, man, that's tragic.
Yeah.
They didn't have a chance. Like, where do you go? The abusive mom? They didn't have a chance.
So the bodies of Jones's five children were discovered in black trash bags off of a rural dirt road in Camden, Alabama.
Damn, he drove all the way to Alabama.
Yeah. Well, he was going to drive further, but we'll touch on that in a little bit. On Saturday, September 6, 2014, Jones was stopped in his Cadillac Escalade.
Well, see, I can't put a mark on this because, like... they're really white trash, but then sometimes they're throwing in these, like,
he works for Intel.
I know, but they have white trash tendencies.
Right. He works for Intel. He drives an Escalade.
Your family meeting's at Chick-fil-A. Like, there's, like...
and he lives in a... I mean, I'm not shooting this down. I mean, you know, you got to live where you got to live. Like, like we talked about, if you listen to the show for a while, I've actually admitted that I've lived in a trailer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's what is available to you and what you can afford and all that other kind of shit, whatever. But, I mean, there's a lot of, like... miscues, I guess.
Yeah, I can't throws put the story my finger. Off, right? Yeah, I need to see pictures. I need pictures. Yeah. I need. I'm gonna deep dive onto this after.
Yeah. So yeah, on September 6, 2014, Jones was stopped in his Cadillac Escalade on a routine traffic checkpoint in Mississippi. Police noted that Jones seemed very strange and maybe on the violent side, whatever that means. Initially, police suspected him of driving while under the influence, but when they checked his South Carolina license, they were notified of the missing children. Further, police found blood and materials. Okay, now this is going to fucking set you for a spin. Police found blood and materials to produce methamphetamines in Jones's car.
What? Yeah, but what does that mean? Did he have some Sudafed?
I don't know. Like 800 boxes of it? I don't know.
See, this is what I'm saying. Driving an Escalade, but he obviously probably smoked meth before.
Or he's a dealer.
Yeah, or he sells meth, right?
Let me know. They found a handwritten note that details how he mutilated the bodies. He said he was also high on synthetic marijuana.
Oh, he was on the spice?
Yeah.
Oh, no, this guy's white. This guy is complete white trash. Yeah, yeah, dude, how the fuck do you keep, like...
Is that the, what they call K? K?
K2.
K2?
Yeah.
That's synthetic marijuana,
yeah,
right?
K2 will make you fucking...
Eat people in alleys?
Yeah. I don't know. K2 is that I remember. Remember you could just buy it at a gas station when it first came out?
I don't know.
You could buy that shit at a gas, like at the gas station.
Really?
Yeah. Where any gas station in Connecticut had just K2 over the counter. They didn't like display it, but you just be like, hey, can I get a bag, like a gram of K2? And they'd sell it right to, I'm not even kidding. And then you would just roll it up like a joint and smoke it with your friends and shit. And then.
What the fuck?
People started having like crazy hallucinations and shit, and they were like, whoa, 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 and they had to quickly do a FDA crackdown on it.
Yeah. Alright, so several days later, Jones led the Mississippi sheriff and FBI agents to where he disposed of the children. It was later revealed in court that Jones originally planned to dump the bodies near the Mexican border. Now, it's unclear why Jones stopped in Alabama, but that's where he ended up. So, prosecutors posited that the stench of decomposition made Jones change his plans. Jeez. Like, his car reeked, and he's like, yeah, I'm not fucking making it all the way to Mexico.
I wonder, you think he was high when he killed his family?
He had, I mean...
He's probably up on the
He's
spice.
Got a fucking meth lab in his fucking meth car.
Yeah.
You know, he's smoking K2.
If he's doing meth and smoking spice, like, he might have just lost his fucking mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because meth is a very violent drug, too. Yeah. On top of that.
So we're gonna touch on things a little bit later, where... All of this kind of like comes together as far as like the meth and all that kind of shit. All right. And then an officer at the scene spoke that the car smelled like the stench of death, and it was filled with blood, bleach, and maggots.
Holy shit, dude! You're the arresting officer that day. You pull over a car with five murdered children's bodies, a dude high on fucking K2. And a whole bunch of like a meth factory in the car. That is a wild.
Right.
That is a wild day. For
How
that,
was your day at work today,
officer.
Honey?
Well. What the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy shit.
All right. So we're going to touch a little bit on the autopsies here. So Dr. Janice Ross, who performed the autopsy, cited that the black bags sped up the decomp since they were placed in the sun. The bodies had been outdoors for approximately 1 week before they recovered. In her report, she indicated that the bodies had been significantly decomposed by animal eating and maggots. Elias was the first autopsy performed. She noted that the body was in two separate trash bags and was clothed in short-sleeved Saks Gotha shirt, which is the school. The report indicated that there was tissue loss at the neck. Skeletonization. Affidavit. At the hands. Decomposition, skin discoloration, internal organs decomposing, no natural disease, fracture of bone and neck, which signifies strangulation. Mara, the second autopsy, was reportedly unclothed. Ross indicated that the child's left hand was missing and that there was significant tissue loss on her body. Gabriel's autopsy reported that he had two parallel lines on the side of his neck, indicative of a ligature made by something wide, such as a belt or a sash. Abigail, the fourth autopsy, had an empty stomach and had the least amount of decomp. Lastly, the fifth autopsy, Natan, revealed that the child's knee was cut with a saw or other sharp object. The body also had an incisor injury on the left femur. Ross determined that the cause of death for all five children to be asphyxiation due to manual strangulation, listing each death as a homicide, but was unable to identify a specific time of death because of the decay. Further, there was only one child with food in their stomach. Therefore, Ross posited that the children could have already been weak and starving when they were murdered.
Jesus Christ.
Jones was extradited to South Carolina. The acting sheriff at the time stated that Jones initially refused to indicate why he murdered his children. But according to court records, here we go. Here's where the K2 comes and the meth comes in. Jones claimed he feared his kids were going to kill him, chop him up, and feed him to the dogs. His fucking children.
That is such a strong statement and like an epiphany for him.
Yeah.
That... Especially if he was high on meth and K2 and that stuff, because that's his own subconscious knowing that he's doing a horrible job and doing treating these kids so bad that he feared that they were gonna they were gonna turn on him.
They're gonna turn on him.
We hear stories about this all the time. Mm-hmm. Abused kids will just walk into their parents' their room and shoot them.
Right.
So subconsciously he knows.
He's like, I'm such a fucking shitty parent.
Yeah.
That my kids are gonna revolt and fucking kill me.
But that's come on, dude.
Yeah.
You can change. You have the self realization. Yeah, you have the self realization.
Lay off the K2.
Jesus.
Close the doors on the meth lab.
Both those paranoia inducing drugs. So I don't want to give him credit and say like, oh, it's that easy that you can say like, oh, that's the reason why I killed him. Because that kind of gives him an out, I guess.
Yeah.
But I could see how that went. At that time he might have believed it.
Right. But all right, so the verdict, after 15 days of testimony, on June 4th, 2019, a jury found Timothy Jones guilty of all five murders. On June 13th, a jury agreed on the existence of an aggravating circumstance and sentenced Jones to death. In 2021, he had his appeal, and he requested that the South Carolina Supreme Court look at the case. Jones' attorney...
Well, what's there to look at here?
If you have appeals, you might as well take advantage of them, I guess. I don't know. Jones' attorney claims that the trial was unfair. And on March 29, 2023, the court issued an opinion affirming his conviction and death sentence. And he is now awaiting his execution on death row.
Oh, good old South Carolina, where we still kill fucking scumbags.
Yep.
Looking back on this, I need to find that body cam footage from the arrest.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, it's Alabama. They don't use body cameras down there, boy. We just make up our own rules down in Alabama. I just thought about that. There probably isn't body cam footage.
Yeah. All right.
it's probably Sheriff Jethro in his fucking his minivan that he throws a fucking light on top.
Criminal AF, we'll be back after this quick break. What's good, everybody? Nothing says I am one of the debauched like Criminal AF apparel and merchandise. Choose from multiple designs that fit your style and your attitude. For women, for men, around the home, or at the office. You can look great repping Criminal AF wherever you go and help support the podcast as well by visiting criminalafpodcast.com/shop or click on the link in episode description.
Go get you some merch.
Yes, sir. Now back to Criminal AF. All right, next on the list of shittiest of shit stains is fucking Ronnie O'Neill, all right? He was born on July 27th, 1988. He did not know his biological father when he was younger and only knew him when he became an adult. He was raised by his stepfather, Billy Smith, and he had a brother named Alonzo Kelly. Now, Ronnie experienced childhood trauma when he was young. At the age of 5 years old, he was sexually abused by multiple extended family members. Unfortunately, he didn't get the treatment where he needed, which traumatized him for the rest of his life. He grew up in somewhat of a stable home, if you call that stable.
Oh, your uncle's coming into your bedroom. Yeah. Creepy Uncle Kyle.
Now, before I said that he converted to being a Muslim, but he was raised as a Christian and sang in a church choir.
That makes sense, because when you hear the family names and then Ronnie the Muslim, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah. Now, he went on to study in East Bay High School.
Saved by the Bell.
Hey, Screech, what's going on, buddy?
Zach Morris is so
he's
hot.
He's so dreamy. Hey, Kelly, you want to go on a prom? All right, he went to East Bay High in Florida where he played football. Oh, he was there with Mario Lopez.
What was
his name?
I don't remember.
What was Mario's name?
Why can't I think? I used to watch Saved by the Bell all the time.
Yeah. I forget. I don't know. All right, he also participated in the Reserve Officer Training Corps, a college program offered to students to become officers in the U.S. military. He graduated high school and tried joining the Marine Corps, but he failed the entrance exam
many occasions. Dude. That just goes to show that he doesn't have the highest IQ because you couldn't pass the ASVAB on multiple tries to even get into the Marine Corps?
Yeah.
Shout out to all our Marines out there, boys. Yeah. Love y'all. But I'm just saying, even they'll agree, all right?
Like I would say, we talked about this before, I wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed when I was fucking in school, but I did exceptionally well in the ASVAB.
You're going to join the military?
Yep.
Dang.
Yep. Medical issue held me back.
What did you want to do? What was your dream job in the military?
I was going to be an MP. Yeah, I wanted to be a cop, but couldn't do that. So here we are.
Secure top flight security of the world, Craig.
All right, so when the Marines failed, he started getting into music and began writing songs and performed in a hip-hop duo.
Oh, man, this guy just keeps getting better and better. Yeah.
In 2007-2008, Ronnie met his girlfriend, Kenyatta Barron, and they lived in Riverview, Hillsborough County, Florida. They had their first child, a daughter named Rodnevea O'Neill, in 2009. Their daughter was diagnosed with cerebral palsy and autism and could not speak. She was wheelchair-bound and used sign language to communicate.
Wow.
In 2011, they had their second child, a son named Ronnie O'Neill IV, and in 2016, the couple split. Now, on March 18th, 2018, at 11:43 p.m., Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office got a 911 call from Kenyatta, and Ronnie could be heard in the back screaming, "Allahu Akbar," which means "God is the greatest" in Arabic. Now, Kenyatta, who was shot in the arm and hiding in a closet at the time of the call, is pleading and screaming, "I'm so sorry, Ronnie, I'm sorry," as she's on the phone call. Now, Ronnie can be heard in the background saying, "She killed me. Don't come outside. Call 911 now," whatever all that means. And at one point, you could hear him yell to little Ronnie, who was 7 at the time, "Get in here and shoot this bitch."
Whoa.
Okay. Now, Kenyatta managed to escape and ran out into the front yard, and Ronnie chased her down. A neighbor who witnessed the altercation saw him hammering on her with a shotgun.
What?
Probably with the butt end of it, like basically like swinging it like a fucking bat, 3 times before fatally shooting her in the front yard. He then went back inside, and here's where the shitty fucking parent really takes a toll. He went back inside and hacked his 9-year-old autistic, nonverbal, wheelchair-bound daughter apart with a hatchet.
Wow.
Yep. He then stabbed his 7-year-old son, Ronnie IV, leaving him for dead, and he lit the house and Ronnie on fire. Little Ronnie on fire. Okay, so the little boy is stabbed and on fire.
Wow, man.
At 11:49 p.m., deputies arrived to find Kenyatta in the front yard of the home. At 11:51, with deputies outside treating Kenyatta and assessing the situation, Big Ronnie called 911 a second time, claiming to have been attacked by white demons, and accusing Kenyatta, who he called Kiki in the call, of trying to kill him, while also admitting that he just killed her. Meanwhile, while all this is going on, little Ronnie had stumbled out of the house, heavily bleeding and burned. He was alive, obviously, but he was barely clinging to life. Like, this kid's not going to make it.
Okay? Did he?
Stay tuned, Garrett. We're learning as we go along. So Ronnie O'Neill, he came out of the house shortly after.
What a fucking trooper, dude. Yeah. 7? How old was he? 8?
Yeah, 7.
7 years old?
Yeah.
And to go through that and then still get enough fucking strength and not just lay there, get up and walk out of that house?
Yep. So O'Neill came out of the house shortly after and fought with police before being tased and was taken into custody. He quickly changed his story and claimed that Kenyatta was the one who attacked the 2 children and that he killed her in self-defense. Okay. Ronnie O'Neill chose to represent himself and had one of the most outlandish opening statements. He constantly disrupted the court with drama and antics, and his closing statements were fucking off the fucking rails.
I mean, we got to see a little of that with the guy who drove the car.
Yeah, the Keisha parade.
Absolutely ridiculous, and that's good because this motherfucker is going to get everything thrown at him.
Right, yeah. At times during court, he was screaming his head off and becoming totally animated and, like I said, just creating a whole fucking scene. Interestingly enough, the judge did, they had to keep his antics and word and comments and stuff for the record, so that if, to show that he was competent in his questions, in case it came up with, in the appeals process. Saying that he wasn't, you know,
given his time to talk. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, like I said, going back to that public trial that everybody kind of probably saw if you followed true crime or
right. Yeah, he was fucking off the rail.
But the judge did. Everybody was talking. Like I saw a lot of articles and like stories saying how well the judge did, so that there would not be a mistrial, so there would not be, like, that's what he was hoping. He was just trying to get it so he can use the trial as ammo for later. So
now, with him representing himself as his own attorney, it also gave him the ability to cross-examine little Ronnie, who survived.
Oh my god!
And is now 11 years old.
There should be some sort of protection.
Yeah. Well, the protection in this case was that he was not present. He was via closed circuit TV.
Oh, that doesn't matter, man. You're still talking. Oh, that's horrible. I feel so bad for that. Yeah. That kid is gonna be like, it's amazing that he survived, but he's gonna have to work through some shit, right, man.
There is a silver lining in this, and we'll go a little bit more. So the brave boy, little Ronnie, he was being cross-examined by his father via closed-circuit TV with his golden retriever therapy dog and his newly adopted family by his side. When asked by his father upon cross-examination, "Did I hurt you that night of this incident?" Little Ronnie replied, "Yes." He's like, "How did I hurt you?" Little Ronnie said, "You stabbed me. And I swear this guy fucking got his fucking rocks off asking his little boy these questions." You know what I mean? Because where else do these questions like lead to?
Yeah, why?
Other than trauma to your fucking kid. You know what I mean? Anyway,
that poor kid has to live with that for the rest of his life.
Yeah. So after a three-week trial, the jury deliberated for a little more than 3 hours and found him guilty, but decided against a death sentence because the aggravating circumstances in the case did not outweigh the mitigating circumstances. Whatever that means, I don't even fucking know. He should fucking die. You hacked your fucking 9-year-old daughter in a wheelchair to death with a machete. No, you're gonna fucking die, dude. You're gonna die. I don't care what the circumstances are. So, anyway, in lieu of death, he received 3 life sentences plus 60 years and was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of attempted first-degree murder, 2 counts of aggravated child abuse, 1 count of arson, and 1 count of resisting law enforcement. As lawyers spoke, O'Neill doodled on his paper. He flashed signs towards the news cameras and courtroom spectators. One read, "Love you." Another read, "Only no sin cast first stone."
This guy is just out of his fucking mind.
All right, and Ronnie O'Neill is now serving out his 3 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole at Blackwater River Correctional Facility in Milton, Santa Ana County, Florida.
Well, there's at least he doesn't have the possibility of parole.
Right.
So.
Silver lining, okay? Here's a silver lining. Detective Mike Blair, who had shown up at the scene after little Ronnie had been transported to the hospital, was there to serve a search warrant of the property. Now, Mike Blair, he's a detective in the homicide.
The homicide division?
Homicide division, yes. So after working the scene, Detective Blair went to visit the boy in the hospital, which at that point, not many thought he would make it through the night. Detective Blair would return several times to the hospital to check in on little Ronnie and would bring him items from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. One night when Blair was leaving his room, little Ronnie reached out and grabbed Blair's hand and asked, "Will you watch a movie with me?" Blair had to get back to work, but he immediately called his wife. The couple had a date planned for that night, but Blair and his wife knew what they had to do. Later that evening, Detective Blair and his wife watched Transformers with little Ronnie.
Oh, dude, good people always come out.
Yeah. Once cleared medically, Ronnie the fourth ended up in foster care. He had gone through a couple of foster homes. He lived with a couple of family members, but there was never, ever anything like positive in these living situations. So several months later, the liaison for the case reached out to Detective Blair and asked if they would be interested in fostering little Ronnie. He didn't even pause. He answered yes without even checking with his wife because he knew what her answer would be. A year and a half later, they officially adopted Ronnie, who is now Ronnie Blair. He resides in Florida with the detective, his wife, his 5 new siblings, and their dogs. He wants to be an actor when he grows up and has done wonderfully through a lot of love and therapy. He is quoted as saying, of the Blairs, "They are really nice people. They are the best moms and dads, and they really take care of me. There is no one else better than them." So.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Positive end to the story. You know, there was a little rainbow at the end, you know what I mean? Good for him. Criminal AF would be back after this quick break.
Do you like scary movies?
If your answer is yes, then you got to check out my show, Fright Flick FMK. My name's Jay, and along with my co-host Gentleman and Jack, I watch and discuss horror movies and tell you what I think about them, new or old, mainstream or underground. No horror flick is safe from my warped opinion. So listen to Fright Flick FMK now. It's on all major podcast platforms and YouTube. Also, be sure to follow the show on TikTok and Instagram. But be warned, this promo is the longest amount of time you'll hear me talk without swearing or cracking an offensive joke.
Now back to Criminal AF. All right, now we move on to our last story of a shitty parent, and this one will be shared by our friend and co-host of the upcoming podcast, Freaky As Fuck, Chris Owen. How you doing, Chris?
Cheeky!
Hey.
Hey.
How's it going, guys?
Hey.
Now, when we were talking about this this story, we were joking around, and I named it This Old House, and then you named it This Old Box. you came back with This Old Box. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
But anyway, all right, so I'm going to tell a story, and then you just jump in and correct me if I'm wrong or whatnot, because what I want you to do is tell a little story, just a kind of brief run up of why this story is significant to you.
Well, basically, my husband and I raised kids for almost 20 years in the house where these murders took place.
Oof.
And we moved in there about 2 to 3 years after the murders happened.
Oh, wow.
And so we were the next people living in the house besides the girlfriend of the murderer who lived in there for about a year and a half before us.
Now, did they tell you about the murders before you moved in?
Yeah, we actually had been looking for a house to buy, and then our realtor, who's a friend of ours, as we pulled in the driveway, he kind of turned to us and said, oh,
by the way,
he didn't realize until he was en route where what place it was. Yeah. So it was kind of threw him off as well. And then he said, do you guys still want to see it? And I felt an immediate pull. It was kind of a long driveway going down to a rancher, and I just felt an immediate pull to go down and just check it out and see how I felt about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it was definitely a little bit scary of a proposition for me, not because of haunting or anything like that. It was because our daughter at that time was the same age as the young girl who was killed.
Yeah.
So it was... It just was a little bit, we weren't sure whether we were going to go for it. But once we moved into the place, we decided to do it, and we moved in. It was more about just wanting to bring a better presence to the house and the neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to explain, but I just felt a real pull to do it.
And yeah, I get it.
Especially being married to a guy who's just an amazing dad, really wanting to bring that kind of energy to the house.
Right.
Yeah.
A side note to Garrett. Now, if you and Kelly were going to look for a house and the realtor said, hey, a family was murdered in this house, would you guys...
I can't speak for Kelly because I know she'd be like, absolutely not. Yeah. But for me, like I said, we go back and forth all the time. Yeah. I'm not a big spiritual guy. I don't believe in ghosts and stuff like that. Yeah. So to me, like, sure, you're going to give me X amount of money off the house because there was a murder there? I'm fine. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I don't mind it.
That's actually a question... Sorry, that's actually a question we got asked a lot, is if we got a really good deal on the house. And I mean, I would say maybe just a tiny bit under what the regular value was, but really not any big of a deal to make that a reason. It was kind of weird. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people where I have my mindset where they don't care. It's not like, because you hear those stories about people getting houses for half off and stuff like that. Right. I don't think that happens as much.
Yeah.
As
well, I have to hand it to both of you because I would never.
I know you would.
I would never.
I know you would.
Ever live in a house where somebody was.
But that's your own mind. You'd be like, I swear to God, I saw the little girl walking down the hallway.
Yeah. The wind blows. I'm like, it's fucking haunted.
But also, I getting to know you, and everybody who doesn't know or listening and don't know who Chris Owens is, she's one of our best Patreons. She's one of our best active Discord users. Yep. She's just awesome in general. She helps us with the stories a lot.
Oh, yeah. She comes up with a great crime scene photos, too.
That's what I'm saying. Getting to know, like, you... At this point, I know that doesn't bother you at all. You're right. Definitely, I would say that you're definitely kind of, you're not into that stuff, but you definitely have a pull towards true crime.
Yeah, for sure.
Horror and paranormal kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and at the time, because it was quite a while ago, I definitely was not, I was more spiritual than into sort of the actual scientific end of death and everything to do with it.
Right.
But over the years, I've kind of just, my lens has gotten a little bigger where I see everything more rounded. So more the science end of it and all of that. But it wasn't anything that I ever felt really uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
I was quite comfortable with death really from a young age. So it was more going to be about if I walked in that house and felt like, oh, fuck no.
Yeah, some bad juju.
It would have been a no.
Right.
Yeah, it would have been a complete no. Yeah. But I actually just felt emotional and almost like it was, I wouldn't say a challenge, but it was just an actual pull. I don't really know how else to describe it.
Yeah.
But no, it didn't. It bothered me in the way that I got emotional in the house knowing what happened there. Quite emotional, actually. But I didn't feel like there was, you know, spirits stuck there and stuff like that. And I kind of delved down that quite a bit.
Right.
Now, are you still living there today?
No, we moved away from there. It'll be 5 years in November. And sold the house after not living in there for a couple of years. So it sold about 2 years ago.
Gotcha.
Nice. All right, so well, first, before we get into the story, I just want to give a shout out to our Patreon members and those who, you know, through Buy Me a Coffee or just, you know, one time donations and whatnot. I just want to thank them because this call is brought to you by them. With our new Rodecaster Pro 2, we can now do live calls and record these sessions with, because right now, Cheeky is probably not 6,000. How far away? You're probably like 3,000. 4,000 miles away from us right now?
Yeah, I think it's close to 4.
Yeah, so 4,000 miles away, and here we are, sounding great, like we're live in studio, and here we are. So, thank you all for helping us out and improving the show. All right, so this story is about Douglas John Holtum, right? Did I pronounce that right? Holtum.
Yeah.
All right, so John was born in 1960 in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Now, did you live in Canada your whole life?
Yeah, born and raised in British Columbia. So now we're living out about an hour away from Vancouver on the ocean. So
it's a lot nicer
than the concrete jungle.
You have a beautiful, beautiful home out there.
Yeah, Chris is definitely Chris is definitely pinky up now, you know?
Yeah. Just a little fancy.
That is good. Posh.
Yeah. Well, you guys, I'm sure you worked hard for it.
And she doesn't have that, like, Midwest Canadian accent either. Like,
right.
Like, hey, bud.
Yeah.
Well,
so I live in this house,
good.
Eh?
Hoose.
Oh, the hoose bud. It's a hoose bud.
Yeah. A boot. All right, so this John guy, Douglas John Holtum, he was born in 1960 in Vancouver, British Columbia. For those who don't know, that's in Canada. Oh, we can actually hear the seagulls.
I know.
By the ocean.
I was just going to say,
nice.
Wow. Nice little ambiance as we tell this story.
Right now, we're in a dingy basement with spiders all over it. She's sitting outside in the fucking, looking out over the ocean.
Yeah.
She's
well watching.
Just so you don't hear the dogs. Just so you don't hear the dogs bugging me in the background.
Yeah, no, it's fine. All right, so he grew up in Cloverdale, British Columbia, and he met his wife, Leonora. What, Lenora? How do you say it? Lenora?
It looks like it says Leonora, but she went by Lenora.
Lenora, okay.
Lenora.
All right, he grew up in Cloverdale, British Columbia, where he met his wife, Lenora, in high school, where they were high school sweethearts. They ended up getting married in 1986, and they had two children. Cody was 8, and his younger sister, Jenny, was 6, and they were expecting their third child as Lenora was 4 months pregnant. And this is all at the time of the murder. And during this time, they lived in a home in Mission, British Columbia. Now, Holton's sisters, they loved Lenora and the children and enjoyed visits with them. And people in the neighborhood knew him as a happy-go-lucky, sweet teddy bear kind of guy. He also coached his kids' basketball, and he worked as an installer for irrigation systems. All right. Now, this is where things start getting a little iffy. So this guy, up until this point, this guy's a stand-up
individual. Perfect family right
here. Yeah, he's a great dude. He's got the family. Yeah. You know, he's the coach. He's, like, got all friends with all the neighbors. All right. And then here comes the side piece.
Oh, no. It's a side piece story. That's so unfortunate.
Yeah. All right. So
the side piece.
In mid-September 1997, after slightly more than a decade of marriage, Holton traveled to Vancouver Island on business, where he met Shannon Goddard at a Victorian country bar.
Damn succubus, dude.
Oh, yeah. Fucking Shannon. Here comes Shannon. Here comes Shannon with her big tits, a fat ass. Without a care in the world.
And her bad hokey jewelry.
Some Leah Sophia on, dude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so Goddard was a Western.
I think it was a karaoke bar.
Oh, really?
That makes it even worse, dude.
Oh, yeah. The karaoke bar.
Yeah, I think it was an actual karaoke bar. And it's pretty, there's some parts of Vancouver Island that are, you know, more rural than others. Right. And there's some pretty, I mean, it's an amazing place, but there is definitely some, a little bit of hillbilly going
trashy,
on over there.
A little white trashy places. Going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so Goddard was a Western wear designer. Okay, she was divorced with two children, and Holton had found his honky tonk love.
Oh my God! Don't say that.
He's like, "How you doing, pretty darling?" All right. So he told a friend that he just encountered his soulmate, but he did not tell Goddard that he was married. Ooh. Okay. A little sneaky. All right. So after he returned, okay, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so there was different conversations floating around of whether or not she actually knew if he was married or if he didn't tell her right away, but she knew within a really short amount of time.
Oh, yeah. That's usually the case. That's usually the case. And at that point, you have to make a business decision whether or not you're going to stay together or
you going to be a piece
on the
of
side,
shit,
right?
Or are you going to keep it moving?
Right. And usually in those cases, either
a side piece of shit.
Yeah,
a side piece of shit.
There
I
you
like
go.
That. Yeah,
I like that. So at that point, that you know, you have to make a business decision on whether you're going to stay with them. And usually, it comes down to whether there's money involved, lots of money, or the dude has a fucking horse cock. It always comes out.
He
to
did
two
have
things.
A porn stash.
He did. Ooh, right there.
He had a definite porn stash.
Yeah, sold.
Yeah. She probably saw that big old honky tonky belt buckle.
Yeah.
And she was smitten.
She was like, "What's underneath belt?"
That's not necessarily the only case. You know what I mean? A lot of there's some people get off on.
Being
a home wrecker. There is for both sides, man, male and female.
Yeah.
So you never know.
The challenge.
All right. So he also told a friend that he encountered his soulmate, but he did not tell Goddard he was married. We already covered that.
Right. I met my soulmate. Karaoke
at a
Western
at a honky tonk karaoke
Christ.
Mall.
Yeah, I'm sure you did, buddy.
Motherfuckers.
I'm sure you did.
All right. So after he returned home, Holton kept in touch with Goddard by phone, and the two wrote steamy, passionate letters to each other through snail mail. Remember those days?
In 1997, though? Yeah, like, come on.
Wasn't AOL around in 97? I think it was, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, it probably took as long
to fucking... Yeah, probably not out in Mission.
Probably took just as long with the fucking dial-up, but hey, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
All right, so... During a phone call on October 7th, 1997, Goddard expressed concern about the future of their relationship, and Holton told her, "I will prove my love to you." All right?
Ooh, that sounds creepy.
So, we know what this podcast is all about, and so let's get into the nitty-gritty of this. On the morning of October 8th, 1997, Holton murdered his wife, 37-year-old Lenora, who was 4 months pregnant at the time. He also murdered his 6-year-old daughter, Jenny, and attempted to murder his 8-year-old son, Cody, by bludgeoning them with a hammer in the head.
Jeez.
A hammer. At 7:45 a.m., a neighbor from across the road went to check on Lenora after she got a call from Lenora's mother. She called her daughter every morning at 7 a.m. and was not receiving any response to her calls and grew concerned. The neighbor from across the road walked into a scene of horror. She found little Jenny in the living room, her head smashed in. Lenora was nearby in a bedroom with her skull also smashed. The neighbor rushed home and told her husband what she had found and called for emergency help. Her husband went into the home and found that Jenny and Lenora were still alive. Oof.
Wow.
But unresponsive. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Police and paramedics arrived while the lives of the mother and daughter slipped away. And officers, they searched the rest of the house. In a stairwell, they found young Cody, semi-conscious, blood gushing from a gaping head wound, struggling in vain to stand up. Ugh, that paints an awful picture.
Yeah. Okay, another grave.
I will interject that. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I will interject that that was actually a, out of all the parts of the house that used to bother me, it was that stairwell.
The stairwell,
yeah. Really bothered me. Hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think it was just residual trauma of the attack and him struggling and me knowing that probably more than anything.
And I think, like, on a different aspect, you know, stepping away from the story for a second, regardless if you believe in, like, spirits and ghosts and whatnot, a house does carry an aura. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, there's just like history, you know, to it. Where you can just ever walk into some place and you can just feel the history, like the aura of it. Sure. You know what I mean?
Old so, things.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can definitely, you know, see how you would be feeling that, you know, regardless.
I did a lot of cleansing.
Yeah, I'm sure. That works, yeah.
I got a question, though.
I would cleanse the whole house by setting it on fire.
When, as you setting it on fire, as a family, hanging out in the living room, did you ever, like, that to me would be kind of tough. Like, I get why you said the stairwell, you know, kind of was the worst spot in the house for you. But to know that she was laying on the living room floor, like, you didn't look at that spot.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't be able to get that out of my head. Like, I would be trying to enjoy TV, like watching TV or something, and then I just look down at the floor and be like, holy shit. Yeah,
definitely. Sorry. And, you know, there was quite a time where it took probably about a year and a half before I knew exactly where everything happened. And it wasn't until I think I had picked up the kids from school and I was coming home and grabbed old school newspaper, and because he was going to trial, it was the first time I saw listed anywhere in any kind of context exactly where everything happened.
Yeah.
And not to sound dramatic, but I did drop to my knees and just start bawling my eyes out.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was really difficult.
Yeah,
it was, and I sort of inadvertently became so attached to the case and to the people and the victims, I felt part of it just living there.
Yeah.
And so now finally knowing where everything happened, I had heard about the stairwell prior to that, but knowing sort of where everything happened as far as where their bodies were, like before, well, while they were still alive.
Yeah.
That was actually, at that point, I'll be honest, I was almost ready to move at that point. It just hit me so hard. But I worked through it. But you're right, Garrett. There was many times when we would just be in different parts of the house, and I would really try not to let that sort of black cloud hang over my head and just replay visions that I thought, because I'm super visual anyway. Yeah. So I was trying not to let that replay over and over. And quite honestly, I would get distracted by our kids so many times and see them running around and playing and my husband playing with them. And that really, it sounds kind of corny, but that really diffused a lot of that.
Oh, for sure.
Black feeling.
Right.
And I'm sure at some point you just don't think about it.
I don't honestly think that there was ever a time where I wouldn't at least go a few days without thinking about it. I just didn't become obsessive over it, or gotcha. I couldn't have lived there. And it was, I'm a huge empath. And so, you know, I think part of the struggle is that if I let myself, I will go down that rabbit hole of just visually picturing all the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I had to really be aware of that and try to halt that. But it was a definite problem for me sometimes, for sure.
I can also see what you're saying about how watching your husband play with your kids and like the life in the house, laughing and running around could,
yeah,
can you almost feel like you're changing that energy. I see where you're yes. going with that. So that's
yeah,
awesome.
That's kind of part of it. Yeah, it's kind of part of the draw of being there, and it wasn't at all to be in a you know, we're better than people, other people or anything like that. Yeah. It was just, that was part of, well, that I would say that was the main pull that I had, was the house could have been demolished and that would have been the end of the actual physical structure. But there was a lot of different energy in the neighborhood around what happened, understandably. And it was just kind of a real draw to feel like I could possibly make a slight change in that with bringing our family there.
Right.
And I think at the time in my life too, that was very important to me. I think my empath spikes were really, really high at that point. So right. probably a little bit to my detriment, but
that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you can bring positive energy to a dark energy situation is always a good thing. But let's all right, so Cody, as we said, he was semi-conscious, found gushing from a gaping head wound, struggling in vain to stand up. Now, it says here the bone fragments had been driven into his brain, and he had laid in a coma for 2 weeks. Cody was the only survivor, but had no memory of what had happened and or of what had caused his injuries or the deaths of his mother or sister. So, I mean, I guess that's a good thing.
Try to find the silver lining, you know what I mean? Yeah. He wasn't aware, he didn't watch.
Right.
I think he did over time start probably through therapy. I don't want to speak for him, but I think over time, yeah, he did start to have some memory back of it.
Yeah. It says here that Cody, he spent over 4 months in the children's hospital recovering. 4 months. Wow. That's God bless him. Jesus. Lenora died at the scene, and Jenny arrived at the hospital where she was pronounced dead on arrival. Police believe the family was attacked shortly before the arrival of police, but there was no signs of forced entry. At 7:30 a.m., Douglas Holtham, he arrived at his place of employment, for which is about 40 minutes away from his home. Police arrived at his place of work at about 8:30, and he was brought in for questioning for the day, but he was released and without charge and remained a person of interest.
Wow, he just drove to work like it was another Sunday, yeah. Another work day.
Fucking, yeah, it's a Tuesday.
There's actually, there's a lot of different stories of him actually driving to work because you cross a big bridge going from where he would be working to where the house is. And it's thought that he actually tossed the hammer into the river, into the Fraser River, off the bridge.
Police had seized love letters between he and Goddard from his wallet, along with clothes he was wearing for forensic analysis. Cody remained at a children's hospital in Vancouver under police guard, but his father was allowed to visit him daily. While investigators awaited results from the analysis of his clothing, they put Holtham under surveillance. Now, at the funeral for Lenora and Jenny, Holtham took off his wedding ring and put it in Lenora's coffin as it was lowered to the ground.
Oh, wait, that is such a tell.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Afterward, he called Goddard and left for Vancouver Island to see her. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Here's my wedding ring.
Cold-blooded.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's almost eerily similar to the Chris Watts scenario, where it's like, I feel like this is pulling to the, if I can't have them, nobody can. You know what I mean? Like, right. I don't want to be with my wife, but
if I can't have my kids.
If I can't have them, nobody can.
Right.
It's very eerily similar to that.
It's almost like a clean slate thing, right? Because then you're not paying for wife and kids. And
Well, I wonder, bringing up the Chris Watts thing, is that I wonder if this, honky tonk Goddard lady was like, you know what? I don't want, well, no, never mind. She had kids.
I don't want the baggage. Yeah. Could have easily been that situation. He said, "Oh, I'm gonna prove how much I love you."
Yeah.
How do you go from a
doting,
a loving white picket fence family to just being able to turn it on like that?
It's that nana.
I guess. It's that, man. I don't know.
Oh yeah. It's that gushy gush.
Yeah. For for all intents and purposes, he apparently was truly came across, at least outside of the home, with the neighbors and other parents and family, friends and family, that he was just a regular doting father and husband. Yeah. And that he, like, you know how you always hear, you know, was out of left field and never saw that coming. He was a great guy. But apparently, just in my experiences with other people in the neighborhood and other parents who knew the family really well, having conversations with them, he truly was just a regular, seemed like a regular old dad and husband. Right. And
didn't have any weird tics or anything like that.
Yeah, nothing that seemed to stand out to anybody at all. And usually you at least hear a friend or something saying, well, yeah, no, there was this other side, but right, nothing really came up. And so when people say they're shocked by it, I imagine they really truly were shocked by it.
So his immediate departure after the funeral drew concern that he may be so upset that he may harm himself.
So they all thought he was going to commit suicide.
Right.
Meanwhile, he's going to meet up with a side piece.
Lay some pipe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he spent the evening with Goddard.
Went right to the ferry.
Yeah, right to the ferry.
Jesus.
Yeah. He spent the evening with Goddard in the roadhouse where they had met. Oh, they went back to the honky-tonk.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thought of those, like, being in that bar, right, and not having a clue that this guy
Just murdered
his whole family, and then he came to a fucking karaoke bar.
Yeah.
A Western karaoke. That's crazy to me. That's actually crazy to me.
Yep.
It's so weird that you say that, because I think about that a lot when I go into places and I pan
room. Oh, yeah, I do that all the
because
time.
Just because of the research and everything, I'm always panning the room going, okay, 1 in 4, so.
Have some fucked up history.
Yeah.
People watching is fun, I will say that.
All right, so while they're at the honky-tonk, they drank, they kissed, and they slow-danced the country songs. Oh, ain't that so party.
What the fuck?
That's so party. All right, Holtham stayed a week with Goddard. Then the two traveled to the lower mainland and stayed in hotels and around the area, including Mission. By Christmas, Goddard had moved into the Holtham family home, where the carpet still had pieces cut out, removed as evidence by police from the places where the kid's blood has been. How fucking crazy.
Just what the like fuck? Nonchalantly.
Yeah. So
what kind of a person could do that? Just move in where, even if you believe he didn't do it,
right?
What kind of a person could just move in there? And going back to what you were saying with him heading over on the ferry to see her right away and staying a week, you got to keep in mind too that he was allowed to see his son at that point, and he's struggling for his life, and he's over in the honky tonk.
Didn't visit his son.
Yeah, that brings up
in a coma for a week.
With the side piece of shit.
Yeah, that brings up a really good point. Yeah. That's right.
And I have a hard time believing she didn't have a, I'm going to say 50% sure. More, she had to have had more, a 50-50 shot that he did this, and she still had the balls to move in with him. Like, come on.
Yeah, my personal opinion is I sit at about a 95% that she knew.
For sure.
At least knew about it. Maybe not necessarily before, but I think she probably had a pretty good indication. You got to think what their conversations were probably like. Yep. And then him saying, oh, I'm going to prove it to you. She's not going to hang up and think, well, I'm going to get a dozen roses.
Jeez.
You know, she obviously, that's just my opinion, just in the whole.
I agree with you.
Overall, general feeling of it all.
All right, and this, yeah.
I hope she's listening.
She said, I hope she's listening.
I hope she's listening.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Fuck you,
we
bitch.
Know, we know.
We know you, honky tonk, you know.
Yeah.
All right, so
succubus.
Yeah. November 3rd, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that. You know, I've had my share of honky tonks, karaoke, rendezvous.
Rendezvous.
All right, anyway, so on November 3rd, 1997, with no conclusive evidence against him, that's crazy. Police set up an undercover Mr. Big Sting investigation targeting him. All right, so for those of you that don't know what a Mr. Big Sting is, it's a highly controversial sting operation that was developed in Canada and is sometimes used to elicit confessions from criminals.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
So you can't do that in America.
You can't. Nope. When the suspect gets deep involved in this Mr. Sting operation. They usually believe that they are going to get large sums of money, so they need to prove themselves to the big boss. Mr. Big Sting is the big boss.
Gotcha.
They understand that they're working in situations usually involving guns or drugs and lots of illegal activity, sometimes, you know, like mafia style. This usually results in them giving a confession about something huge that they have done to show that they can be trusted, that Mr. Big has something to hold over them if needed. So, you know, they kind of reel you in with like little side jobs. Hey, you know, you can make, you know, $1,000 doing this. You can make $5,000 doing this, so on and so forth. And then when it gets up to like 50,000, 500,000, a million, they're like, whoa, whoa, okay, now listen, you know, you've done a lot of good work for us. However, Mr. Big, he's still a little fucking iffy about you. So you have to tell us, you have to admit to us something that you have done to kind of make it even. You know what I mean?
Wow. It's like a reverse undercover.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Yeah. And he's very involved.
And it's all controlled because obviously all these drug deals and gun deals and everything are between agents.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So Mr. Big is still legal in Canada, but it's much harder to have it admissible in court. The use of this technique is also prohibited in the UK and the United States. Now, in Germany, which has high standards for what compromise of is a voluntary confession, it may be more difficult to use confessions obtained using Mr. Big, and it has been used by police in Australia and New Zealand. And its use has been upheld in courts by both countries.
I feel like an American lawyer could easily win that case, though. Because 100%, they could say, yeah, like, it struggles for money, whatever. You're making him make stuff
entrapment.
Up. Yeah.
It's
entrapment.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this particular sting involved over 60 police officers and cost over $1 million.
Holy.
And took 6 months. Now, posing as criminals, they paid him two small sums for jobs appearing to be associated with crime. And as time went on, Holtum was full-time driving trucks and picking up bags of automatic guns from boats and counting large sums of cash.
Damn.
Yeah. By late April of 1998, the officers had convinced him that he would get $150,000 for helping to offload a huge amount of contraband guns and drugs at a site along the coast. Police felt they built up enough trust to make their suspect an offer. If he spilled the details about what happened on October 8th, a terminally ill man would confess in his place to the crimes and take the fall.
Whoa.
So,
and that's a lot of stuff happening in 6 months,
right,
from the time of the murder.
Yeah.
That's only 6 months.
Right.
And yeah, that's, and you got to think his son was in the hospital for 4 months.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. He's very busy.
Yeah, very busy. He's going to honky-tonks. He's singing karaoke. He's
smuggling
guns.
But at this point, he thinks he's Jefe.
Drugs. Yeah.
He thinks he's
El Chapo.
Yeah, he thinks he's El Chapo at this point. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's got rid of the family. He's got money coming in. He's got his side piece of shit. Yeah. And he's good to go.
Side piece of shit.
I fucking love that. Side piece of shit. All right, so Holtum took the bait, and police secretly recorded his confession on video. So the day he told the undercover cop he had woken up before dawn, quote, "I went and got a hammer off the back porch, went in, hit Lenora with it in the bedroom. It woke my daughter. She came out of her room and saw what was going on. So I went out there and I did the same thing to her. Went upstairs to check on Cody, and he was at the top of the stairs, awake, too. So I did the same thing there at the top of the stairs," unquote. Question further, Holtum revealed that he'd attacked his wife while she lay sleeping in her bed, and then he smashed a hammer 3 times to each side of the skulls of his children.
Oh.
"And this is the amazing part," quote, he said in the midst of the story. "It's that it almost like it never happened. Never happened."
Wow, what a sociopath.
Unquote, yep. "The crime did not disturb his rest," Holtum said. "I think about it all the time, but it doesn't stop me from sleeping."
Whoa.
Yeah. So,
he's cool.
Yeah,
that's a cool guy.
Good dude. On October 26th, Douglas Holtum was arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 attempted murder. He was not charged for the murder of his unborn child.
Why?
I think that's an American thing.
Oh, okay.
I think we do that here. I don't know about Canada.
Yeah, I think they're actually bringing that through in some legal cases. I think they're trying to change that here. I could be wrong, but
yeah.
I seem to remember there's been a couple of cases where I think at a certain term of the pregnancy, then it changes.
Right. I also think America's legal system is really based on faith too. So like, you know what I mean?
Right.
A new unborn baby being a they're trying to establish
baby's a person.
In December of 1999, he was sentenced to two life sentences, which in Canada is only 25 years. So a life sentence in Canada is 25 years. So you could be
25 years.
I have heard this.
Yeah. Well, a lot of countries are like that. Like in the United States, life is life.
Oh, yeah. We are the most incarcerated country in the world, baby. We'll put you behind bars forever. Right.
Yeah.
All right. So
it's definitely not a wanted thing here for sure. Yeah. But yeah, 25 years. And I think what you can do 25 years with the possibility of parole and 25 years without the possibility of parole. But in his case, he was also serving them concurrently, which is just bizarre to me.
So at the same time,
like how, because he was up, he was up for parole.
He did 25.
No, he got 25 without parole and two 25
concurrent.
I could be wrong, but I know he was. I knew he was eligible to apply for parole in 2020, I believe. I might be wrong. I think I have it in the notes there. But
think about that, though. You could get you could get
that
two life sentences. You could get two life sentences.
Murder your wife and daughter.
Murder your wife and daughters, right? Get two life sentences. And if you had the possibility of parole, you could potentially get out in 15 years.
10 years, 15 years.
15 years.
Yeah, he was only 40 years old,
that's
too.
That's so crazy to me.
Nuts. I'm moving to Canada.
What? What?
Yeah.
They got free health care, and you can get out of jail 25 years for murdering your family.
That's crazy. Now,
he was only 40.
Question for you, someone who's lived in Canada their whole life. Are you okay with that? Is that like...
No.
Do you think that that's... I don't know how to ask that.
No,
question.
Definitely, I'm definitely not okay with it, and most people that I know are not. I don't even honestly know because I don't.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, what's that?
No, I was gonna say I understand how people are like we're trying to go back on the criminal justice reform and stuff like that. We're trying to like realize and let less people out of jail and you know what I mean, but in here less strict sentencing and stuff like that, but there's certain things where I'm like, no, they deserve to be in jail. Like there's certain violent crimes that shouldn't get that treatment.
And I don't know I haven't delved down too far into the history of certain lawmaking and stuff like that, but I honestly don't even know where that changed, because we used to have some pretty hefty, we had the hanging judge here. I went to elementary school where named after the big hanging judge.
Wow.
Here. And everything used to be different. And then laws changed, and things I'm simplifying it and how I'm describing it. Yeah. But I think it's really hard to go back. I mean, any law is hard to change, but I know that that has been a definite contention here amongst people that I know long time.
Yeah. All right, so what happened to this fucking shitbag that got sentenced to 25 years for murdering his fucking wife and daughter? In December of 1999, he was sentenced to two life sentences. Now, on December 4th, 2021, this fucking piece of shit died of natural causes in prison.
Well, at least he never fucking got out.
Right.
I mean, it sucks that he got to...
Yeah.
Good.
It was a concern for us that he was going to get out.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think of
living
that.
Living in your house, yeah.
Because a lot of those guys come back.
Yeah, it was...
They come back to the place.
Yeah, it was weird.
You're in my house.
It was a weird thing. Yeah. It was more like... I mean, obviously, chances are that wouldn't have happened, but... It still was just one of those things that just sits and takes up space in your head. And I would think about how close we were getting to that. It was definitely a concern.
All right. So, that's got to be fucking nerve-wracking. So now what happened with Cody? So Cody is the surviving victim. He is now 32 years old, and he's living a wonderful life with his partner and two children. The oldest is named Jenny after his sister.
Oh, dude. Yeah.
And,
that made me cry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they live in Kelowna.
That's two stories now of two
surviving,
brave ass kids that were able to pull through.
Great. And he also
right, because you were talking about Ronnie's kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
the
nice
same.
To find some silver linings out of these horrible fucking stories.
Yeah.
And not only is he surviving and thriving and has two children and married and or with a partner, and he's also gives back to the community as a firefighter. So good for him. Good for him. I'm glad everything turned out well for him. That'll do it for Shitty Parents by Criminal AF. Thank you to Chris Owen for sharing her story as well as some of the research on this episode. So thank you very much, Chris.
You're welcome.
Wait, before you go, do you have anything else to add to the story? Do you have any tidbits, information after we just went through it?
Well, nothing that is like super, super short, except for that there's definitely quite a bit to talk about maybe in a paranormal type episode with stuff that I did with the house and with connection with Lenore.
Well, lucky for the
on a spiritual level.
Lucky for the listeners, you can check that out on Freaky AF.
So you know, that's a whole other sort of aspect of it, but it was there's a lot to it, and I think that, you know, all of that really helped with the connection being there, which also makes me I'm quite emotionally connected to the whole thing, even though I'm not a family member, obviously.
Right.
You know, there's still a lot around the whole story.
Yeah.
And I mean, in general, I don't regret being there at all.
Good.
Not at all.
Good.
I can't wait to hear the paranormal aspect of it on the Freaky as Fuck as Garrett. All right. If you found what you heard interesting, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a review or comment on the episode. And don't forget, you can become one of the debauched by joining our Patreon for as little as $2 a month for general support. Everyone gets ad-free episodes and access to our Discord channel. Those who join $5 or above get all of our audible video and downloadable content. And for the higher tiers, you get all of this plus producer credits on every episode and some goodies thrown in. Just go to criminalasfuck.com where you can find links to our socials, support, merchandise, reviews, and more.
Also, you get access to the Discord, and you can talk to Chris about your paranormal or crazy stories.
That's right.
And she'll listen.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right, so here's your part, okay? You ready?
Okay. Signing off from Studio Chloroform. Keep your head on a swivel and stay safe till next time.
See ya!
See ya!
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Now give me our theme music! Executive producers for this episode are Christine Rivera, Beth Davis, Dusty J. Hicks, and Terry Burke Wolin. Associate producers are Paul Hodge, Courtney Seddon, Tara Mazur, Chantel Daggett, Jay Rollins, and Laura Shin. Producers are J.D., Ashley O'Connor, Elizabeth Plus Four, Trent Gobble, Devin Dean, Lisa Perello, Alicia Knight, Maria Sleen, Chris Owen, Justin Ware, and Emily White. Be sure to get your official Criminal AF merch at criminalafshop.com.